Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Your hosts for today are Susan Franzen and Gina McAndrews. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, Gina. We are happy to be with you again. And thanks to our listeners, especially those who tuned in last week when we celebrated Iowa History Month with two indigenous tribes in Iowa that have had especially significant roles in Iowa history. To close out Women's History Month, we'll have two women from those tribes or related ones. And first is Mary Youngbear, who was inducted into the Iowa Women's Hall of Fame in 2020. And I'll read from her nomination. She's rather modest. And so when we talked, she talked about what she was doing, but she didn't talk about what she might brag about. So I'll brag for her. Her contributions as an artist and art conservator, educator, cultural historian, civic leader, and political activist, humanitarian, community leader, and mentor inspire, empower, and motivate all those around her, especially young women and girls. Mary has worked at the Mishkwaki Cultural Center and Museum as art conservator and curator of textiles, beadwork, art, and a variety of regalia and artifacts since 2012. She has helped curate the largest collection of Mishkwaki cultural objects in the world. Besides exhibit preparation and maintenance, Mary leads workshops to revitalize tribal arts,
hosts academic symposiums, and teaches visitors from around the world or Iowans in local communities about tribal history.
Because the Mishkwaki settlement is so unique, I asked Mary to tell the story of its origins near the time Iowa became a state. Her story also tells how she learned the traditional foods and traditional arts from her grandmother when her family left the settlement.
Welcome, Mary. It's an honor to have you with us as the 2020 awardee for the Iowa Women's Hall of Fame. Because the Mishkwaki settlement is so unique, I'd like you to give us a brief history of how it was started and when.
Our people, the ones that stayed in Iowa, lived in different places along Iowa River. And they found this area around Tama and Tama County that we're currently at to be to their liking. It was a place where they felt really comfortable in. So it took some time, but they had relationships with local farmers and the people in this area, and they helped the people that were living out here, the Mishkwaki people, to gather enough of their resources, sell horses, whatever they could do, to raise enough money to buy 80 acres of land. And they had to get permission from the state of Iowa to do so, because at the time it was illegal for our people, for natives anywhere, to purchase land. So that was a really unique situation, and it's a little bit of a miracle that we were able to do it. Purchase date is 1857, July 13th,
1857.
We call that Proclamation Day. That's our tribal celebration, the purchase date.
Were you born on the settlement?
No, I was not. Both of my parents were. And sometime in 1950s, my mom and her mother and family moved to Denver, Colorado through the Indian Relocation Act. And this was a national program. It was an opportunity for Native people to live off of their reservations and settlements and get them into the cities and, I guess, remove them from their way of life. And I guess there was more opportunities for employment and education out in the cities than it was thought it would improve their lives. So they moved all these different people out into the cities, and my grandmother was one of them. She took her family with her. And they chose Denver, Colorado. She chose Denver because she had never been there, and she wanted to start fresh in uncharted waters. And my father followed them at a later date. And so my mother and father married out in Colorado and started their own family. And that's where I came along.
And did you go to school in Denver?
Yes, I did. I went to Denver Public Schools.
And did you study art at all?
No, I didn't. That didn't come till much later. The only thing I did that was a little out of the ordinary was instead of band, I chose orchestra when I was in elementary school. I started playing the violin, so the only thing I picked up. Yes.
Did you enjoy the violin?
Yes, I did.
And do you still play?
I can play. I will say that I play. I lived with my grandmother. Well, I would visit her. Family would visit her on weekends, and because we lived in, we didn't live in Denver. We eventually moved out to Loveland, Colorado, which is, I'm guessing, like an hour away. So the drive to Denver was a while, and we would go up on weekends and visit with her, stay the weekend, and I spent as much time with my grandmother as possible. And it's from her that I learned how to start doing beadwork.
Mm-hmm.
I used to sit with her, and I'd always, like I said, I spend as much time with her as possible. So whenever she was sitting down and doing beadwork, I was usually sitting by her and just watching or visiting, chatting with her. And probably when I was about 7, 8 years old, she started showing me how to do stitches. She gave me pieces of felt to practice on, and she showed me how she did her stitches, like 4 beads at a time, and it was 4 down, you come up the middle through the second bead and go through, and you just keep going and just repeat yourself. And so I started doing that, and that was how my interest in doing beadwork began. It was through her.
She must have been a good teacher.
She was an excellent teacher in practically anything. She was a really well-rounded woman. The only thing she couldn't do was drive a car.
So what else did you learn from her?
Well, I always hung around in the kitchen with her, so I kind of just, whatever she did. I just mimicked everything that she did in the kitchen. And I'm pretty sure that's how I learned how to cook. And it was, you know, trial and error, watching her, that I saw what she did, and I would just try to replicate that.
And did she cook traditional food?
Yes, she did. Everything else, like the different soups, and she was pretty good in the kitchen.
Last week we learned why fried bread is traditional. But what we learned was that there were allotments of food for the Natives on reservations. They gave them wheat flour and lard. And what do you do with wheat flour and lard? Well, I guess you can make fried bread. Is that right?
Well, they kind of, all the different tribes, I guess they were the the people that gave him the flower, initially they didn't know what to do with it. They didn't know what it was. They would empty the flour out and use the bread bags, the sack, the flour sack to make clothing, you know, little shirts or dresses. And they saw that the flour was being wasted, so they had some ladies come in and show them how to make biscuits. Well, they didn't have ovens. They just kind of, I guess, trial and error, found a way to make bread. They figured it out. And fry bread has evolved into what it is now. And every tribe has their own recipe. You know, different cooks have their own recipes. And I have a method, and that works for me.
And it's now become a beloved food, right?
Yes, it has. And we, it's not like something that we eat every single day. It's usually reserved for special occasions, celebrations, birthdays. So it's not like our people are eating it every day. And because of the, you know, it's deep fried, it's not a healthy food to eat every day. It is still part of our diet.
While nurturing her sisters after her parents died, raising her own children, and teaching pre-kindergarten at the settlement school, where children learn the Meskwaki language and study the culture, Mary Young Bear brought art into her teaching naturally. That was no doubt the reason she was appointed curator for the Historical Preservation Department at the Meskwaki Museum and Cultural Center, while she continues to express her love of art through her teaching, loving preservation of artifacts, and her own art.
What subjects do you like to have for your art?
You know, when I was in college, I tried really hard not to make everything about being from my culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a professor that would put out like feathers and a buffalo skull. And he said, "I put these out for you. I want to see what you can do with them." And he did that because I was Native American. And I was kind of a little bit offended by that. And because I felt singled out. And so I tried really hard not to. I avoided. I just went the opposite direction. And he wasn't happy. I mean, I wasn't happy. But in the end, we kind of met right in the middle. And I accepted the fact that I am Native American, and that is going to come out in the work that I do. I can try and, you know, I can try not to identify with my culture, but it will come out in some way. But I was really trying to just be more concerned with methods and how the work came together instead of my identity. And I didn't want that to overpower everything that I did. And like I said, in the end, you know, that's who I am. And I embrace it. I'm grateful for it. And it's there. I'll never be able to not be Native American, be Meskwaki.
They mentioned that you were an artist. And they also mentioned all these art centers that you had pieces in. Did you... were they your Meskwaki art that you brought to them?
Oh, no. If it's in that vein, it's something that I've made. I've had work, like I've done printmaking, monotypes and lithographs, a few paintings. I was really interested in lithography for such a long time, and I really love printmaking, and hopefully someday I'll be able to get back to that. And I'm hopeful. You know, whenever this pandemic decides to disappear, I can get into a studio and do some printmaking. But I've also done some painting, and I've had shows in different museums and galleries where it was just beadwork, or I was part of something else. Like last year, I was part of a weaver's convention, and they had a display at the gallery in Grinnell, and they asked me to submit beadwork. So I did, and I ended up being part of that show, which was pretty exciting.
In case you just tuned in, you just heard traditional Meskwaki music at the end of a conversation with Mary Youngbear, artist, teacher, recently president of the school board for the settlement school in Meskwaki settlement, and conservator at the Meskwaki Cultural Center and Museum. In 2020, she was inducted into the Iowa Women's Hall of Fame. Thanks for speaking with us, Mary.
Our second story for today is about another Native woman, roughly from the other tribe discussed last week. The Dakota, who disappeared from Iowa about the time the Meskwaki were buying land in Tama County, continued to have treaties violated beyond the Missouri River. Maria Pearson is Yankton's Dakota activist who successfully challenged the legal treatment of Native American human remains.
Maria Pearson is the outstanding woman who is the subject of a documentary being made by a group of students from Wartburg College under the direction of Sylvia Oakland, Iowa College Media Association Journalist of the Year. Thank you for coming on Local Talk today with your team to tell us about this exciting project.
Thank you so much. We're happy to be here.
Good to see all of you. And why don't you introduce your team? You are also a student, is that right?
Yes, we are all students. So I'll speak for myself and I'll let them introduce themselves. So my name is Sylvia Oakland. I'm the producer and writer of the group. So my job duties are kind of finishing up and I'm helping out with the production team.
Hi, I'm Courtney Stucker, and I'm the digital producer for our team Simplex Stories, and I do a lot of the blogs and social media that you might see if you follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
Hi, I'm Nathan Stephanie, and I'm one of the videographers and editors for our team.
Hi, I'm Dominic Hansen. I am also a videographer and editor for the team.
I'm Lauren Wisdom, and I am the project manager for our team, so I kind of oversee the whole project.
I know there's must be a lot of research for this, and you couldn't interview Maria Pearson herself. She died in 2002. So what's the story?
That was one of our biggest hurdles when we first pitched for our topic of Maria Pearson. There are two other amazing women that our two other teams are working on, Ruby Sutton and Frederica Bremer, who have both also passed away. So we all knew that we would need to do a lot of research. And it began just doing research about the Yankton Sioux tribe. We all went in and we started with a very wide view, a very big picture view of what Native American culture and Indigenous culture looks like in the United States, what it looked like prior to, you know, present day. And then from there, we narrowed it down to what does the Dakota, Lakota, and Nakota tribes look like, one of the three which Maria was from. And then from there, we kind of honed in and started looking specifically at who was Maria Pearson and what was the advocacy that she did, and what did she change. And I know that Nathan and Dominic also did a lot of that research as well. So I know they could tell you some more with it.
Yeah, I think my initial big takeaway when we first heard about Maria Pearson being one of these possible topics was that we weren't familiar with any of the names, that it just went completely over our heads. We're just like, okay, we have a lot of learning to do. So we just began our initial research phase, kind of beginning to look up each of these three women that Sylvia mentioned. And what initially struck me about Maria's page that we first found was the comparison to Rosa Parks. And that's not a comparison I think that a lot of people take lightly. So that initially just kind of flabbergasted us. That got us our attention right away that, oh, this is really something serious, and began kind of learning a little bit more. And we kept seeing the phrase NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriations Act. And we kept seeing that referred to over and over again as this incredibly important document and this piece of legislation that was passed in the 1990s. And yet no one in our group had ever heard of it or heard of anything that it related to. So I think throughout our research, we just decided this was something that we needed to kind of spread the word on, that it was incredibly important and that this shouldn't be the case any longer, that the word needs to be out.
Another thing that was really interesting in our research that we found is her connection to Iowa. And that makes the story local, and that makes the story worth, you know, exploring in our area, but also because of the national impact that it had. You know, Maria was originally born in South Dakota and then lived in Ames for most of her life. And she was really influential in the Iowa Burial Act in the 70s. And that kind of directly led to her more activism for her, and then led to NAGPRA on the national level.
And I think kind of the final thing that we wanted to make sure was that this story wasn't just a memorial. We wanted it to be truly telling of Maria's life. And we wanted to go through her culture and who she was as a person, rather than just the actions that she did. So our story kind of goes through, it starts out with, you know, the traditions of Maria and the Yankton Sioux, and how she got a lot of her cultural background from her grandmother, because she did straddle, as we like to call it, a cultural line. She went to Catholic private school, but also had these Yankton Sioux traditions that was really important to us. So we touch on that, and then we talk about how her cultural background influences her passion for her advocacy. And then finally, we talk about her advocacy and passion, how that inspires, you know, current Native American women to get involved and to take a stand and to speak out against things that are happening with a lot of the tribes, both locally and nationally. So we wanted, like I said, to really get a bird's eye view and a really good telling story of Maria in a way that would honor her, but continue her legacy as well.
Well, how did she get to Iowa?
How did Maria get to Iowa?
Yeah.
Well, I think it originally started when she had married John Pearson. Am I correct, Nathan and Dominic? Yeah. So she had had two husbands prior to John Pearson, who was her final husband. And he worked for the Iowa Department of Transportation, which at the time was the Highway Commission Council. And so with that, she kind of moved around with him and ended up in Marnie. And he was working on some things in Glenwood, Iowa. And that's when she really started doing a lot of her advocacy work. So it was in her late 20s, I want to say early 30s, is around that time.
Well, and how did, what instigated her concern?
Yeah, this is actually, I think, one of our most favorite stories to kind of tell. So I'll start off and I'll let Dominic and Nathan continue with it, because I know they're itching for it. So it starts off, she's at home making dinner, and her husband John comes home and basically from the stories that we've heard and what we've read, said, you're really not going to want to hear about my day. It was really rough, and I don't think that you're going to like what I have to say about it. And so, of course, that piques Maria's interest, and she's like, well, now you have to tell me. And so John begins to then tell her about the day that he's had.
And what had happened that day?
Well, Sylvia mentioned earlier that John worked for the, it becomes the Department of Transportation, was called something else at the time. They'd been working on a highway project, digging up to build this road out in southwest Iowa near Glenwood at the time. And they came upon 28 older, just grave sites completely out of the blue. They didn't expect to find these people in the ground. And so they began testing who these people were, and they found that 26 of these 28 people were white pioneers from the, I believe, the 1800s or so. And two of them were a Native American woman and her child. And the thing that John thought would upset Maria was that the 26 white bodies were reburied and just taken back and put back into the earth undisturbed. But that same respect wasn't afforded to the Native American woman and her child, and they had been taken to a lab to study. And a phrase we kept hearing throughout our interviews about this story was this discrimination in death, and how this really wasn't fair at all, that, okay, if you're going to take these two to a lab, it's a pretty obvious why you chose these two as opposed to just two random other people. So this just incensed Maria, and she kind of decided to take action.
Yeah, and that led directly into her activism. And so from this point, the Glenwood incident, that's when everything kind of sparked. It was the inciting incident. And she has this moment where she goes outside and she takes kind of like a moment to catch her breath and to kind of rethink everything. And she hears her grandma's voice telling her that she has to stand up for her people. And so she decides to go down to the Iowa Capitol in her regalia during the 70s and go into the governor's office and talk to Governor Ray at the time. She didn't have an appointment. She didn't have anything. She walked into the office and wanted to talk to Governor Ray. Once she got to Governor Ray through some secretaries and everything, she said, give me back my people's bones and you can quit digging them up. And this is the moment where Governor Ray has to decide whether or not he's going to take this request seriously. And Governor Ray kind of just says, do we have her bones? You know, what's going on here? Because he was kind of unaware of the incident that had happened in Glenwood. And Maria really just kind of like brought that to light for the state of Iowa and directly to Governor Ray.
And I think backtracking a little bit too, you know, why did this all matter other than, you know, her grandma's motivation and her helping her learn her culture with the Yankton Sioux? Well, within a lot of, you know, Native American and Indigenous peoples' tribes, they have what's called like the spirit journey or the great mystery, right? What happens after they die? What are their beliefs with death? And in the beginning, I believe, of Maria Pearson's autobiography, she talks a lot about nature and earth and how we are all connected. And when we disrupt our ancestors' journey into death, that is one of the absolute worst things to do. You're going to have karma coming back and, you know, really biting you if you disrupt them. So obviously, if these bones are being dug up, being studied, being sold for profit, their artifacts being sold for profit or being put on display in museums, you can see the like this issue here. And so that's why she cared just so much to march in there in her Native American regalia, all dressed up, going into that governor's office with so much moxie and being like, I'm here to see the great white father. Who can get me that person? So just adding on there, Dominic.
Well, that was Courtney Stucker. And one of the beauties of Zoom is that I can see everybody's faces all the time. And so she's been smiling, and she didn't get to introduce herself in the first round, and she's been smiling, and you had this great, great story. So thank you, Courtney.
No problem.
I know personally some people who've been affected by this because the person who told me about you, Dave Gradwall, is an archaeologist. And it's interesting how this is now, you know, it's now, as you said, a national act. And I'm sure that was...
It was used as Standing Rock. The Dakota Access Pipeline route was disturbing their burials.
And it was used, I think, when the Sayreville Lake, there were a lot of, not necessarily burials, but communities. And maybe wherever there's a community, there are burials. I'm not sure. But they, you know, inspected all of those to make sure that they were not doing anything inappropriate with them. And I think made, you know, decisions on the I think you probably tell us about that. Is that right?
No, I know that we address a little bit of the inequalities that have happened even prior to Maria's time within our documentary. You know, we start off and we talk with Wounded Knee, and I know Nathan did a lot of research on that introduction part, so he might be able to give you some more background on that. But we also talk about, you know, even things that are a little bit maybe more recognizable, like Mount Rushmore and the Crazy Horse Memorial, and how even within that, there are some equalities. And, you know, we touch back on that again in the end of our documentary, talking about how a lot of activism has to do with, you know, clean water rights, looking at the abuse that Native American women tend to face, looking at, you know, the discrimination that Native American and Indigenous peoples tend to face in general. So we kind of try and do a full circle to keep our audience engaged and to keep true to that circle of storytelling that Courtney kind of mentioned earlier with the circles. But I know Nathan can talk about Wounded Knee a little bit more and what that means in relation to our documentary.
Yeah, I think tying back to our research that we talked about earlier, what really struck us as we began getting into the story and began looking for a good entry point to bring in our audience in our documentary was just how immense this history is, that this is not a new thing that's been happening for years. I can speak to my education as an elementary school in central Iowa. You're taught that it happened years ago, centuries ago. But some of our footage of the activism that's going on is all happening from the 1970s on, that we have footage from the occupation of Alcatraz Island happening in the 1970s, even the Dakota Pipeline protest happening in just a few years ago. That's all in there. Sylvia discussed Wounded Knee, that we kind of had to make a judgment call about how far back we were willing to go, that, okay, we can't show 300 years worth of atrocities in this because there's just so much. So we do touch briefly on Wounded Knee and how that kind of ties to the stories of repatriation and the bodies being dug up. We do briefly touch upon in our beginning of the comparisons between Mount Rushmore and Crazy Horse, how Mount Rushmore was this mountain that was partially stolen from Lakota lands, I believe, because pioneers found gold. So the government just took it, which led to the Wounded Knee Massacre, among other things. And then they just started blowing up this mountain that was sacred to the Lakota people to make Mount Rushmore this kind of monument to white U.S. presidents who have their own unfortunate histories with Native Americans. And then 20 years later, when the work on the Crazy Horse statue begins in an attempt to do a similar honor, it never gets completed, that you can go visit the Crazy Horse statue and go see the face on the mountain, but it's nowhere near what they'd originally planned. And there's a possibility that it will never be finished. And so just kind of looking at that comparison when you put it next to all this history, it's just kind of overwhelmed us.
You learn from just doing this project, reading this history, and not just about the story, but just about your own history and how it relates to you in your everyday life.
I would say one of the first things that we learned was, first, within our department, we are really working hard to become culturally aware and culturally educated. Three of us, Courtney, myself, and Nathan, are all part of student media, and we have leader meetings where we discuss certain books. Last semester, we read White Fragility and How to Handle you know, racism and implicit bias within our own communities as white Americans. And then this semester we're reading some things about statistics. So we really try to be culturally aware and culturally sensitive. So I think the first thing that we learned was we didn't know a whole lot about Indigenous communities. I remember one of the first things that we struggled with was finding the proper term for Native Americans or Indigenous people. And we use them interchangeably because I think we learned that both are an appropriate term depending on who you're talking to, and both are kind of one of the better terms to use. We also learned that, you know, if you can refer to them by their specific tribe, their tribal name, that is the best way that you can do it. But in general, using Indigenous people and Native American is one of the preferred ways. So I think for me, and looking at our group, we really got a better sense of cultural awareness, and we found a population that needed their voice to be heard. And we realized that we needed to do that in a way so they were still telling their story, and that we weren't changing too much of what their story had to be.
And I think kind of going off what Sylvia said, you know, about like learning about white fragility and our own bias and about like the systematic forces that kind of, you know, play on our everyday lives and when we don't even realize it's happening. You know, I think the best moments of learning come when you're uncomfortable, when you put yourself out there, when you make mistakes. And I think with stories about, you know, people of color and like Maria Pearson, an Indigenous woman, it's important to make yourself a little uncomfortable because it's a completely different culture. You know, you learn that like maybe your white ancestors did have a lot of issues with them, and it's important to learn about that instead of living in our own ignorance. And so that's something else that has been just absolutely amazing and an amazing learning opportunity from this entire documentary experience.
Lauren?
I kind of agree with what Courtney said. I don't really have anything to add.
I have something that sort of probably leads into the specialties of Courtney and I think Lauren. I can't remember what everybody's jobs are. But one of the things that I did in preparing for the interview with Mary Youngbear was to look at the Meskwaki website, and they have wonderful history. It does go back to where the Meskwaki came from. They're an Iroquoian people, and they had a long meander before they got to first Minnesota, so, well, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. And it's beautifully done, and it's you know, very easy to understand. And I wondered if Mary was part of that, but it's clearly something somebody who really knows videography put together. I recommend it to all our listeners. The Meskwaki website is terrific, and so I can see now that that's a use for journalism that wasn't here 20 years ago.
Do you plan to continue to do this type of journalism?
I would say that for some of us, definitely in terms of filmmaking and just journalistic storytelling is definitely what we plan to pursue professionally. You know, we're all seniors in our final year of college, so we've definitely been doing some poking around, looking, sniffing out some jobs maybe. But you know, kind of going back to the website and internet, you know, it's a double-edged sword, right? Social media and the internet, because anyone can post stories and post their information, and that's great. And it's definitely helpful in terms of leads and finding stories and finding information for stories. But at the same time, there is so much misinformation out there that it can be really hard to kind of sift through and find those really, you know, those strong like gold nuggets of information that can help you. So that's something that we've really wanted to try to remain ethical about, and our promotion, you know, is not being overly promotional. You know, remain. We want to be sensitive to Maria's story, and we want to post only correct information as much as we can. And so that does take a lot of research. It takes a lot of fact checking. And as someone who's more on the PR promotional side of things, you know, it's just the same as if, you know, I was Sylvia and Nathan and Dominic writing the story of the documentary. You know, we all have to kind of remain true to our values in this and yeah, just be ethical journalists.
And I would say, going on your question, Gina, what is great about our capstone project is it combines all the areas of our concentrations. So I know many of us have at least two concentrations. And so within our department, those are multimedia journalism, public relations, digital cinema, and we just recently added sports media. So other than sports media, it includes really all three of our concentrations. You know, with Nathan and Dominic doing a lot of the heavy lifting with the video work, and they're great at it. And Courtney and Lauren really doing a lot of that PR, that public representation, and Ansika helping out with our graphic design and our visual elements as well. She kind of supports both the promotions and productions team. And then Nathan and myself, and I would also say Lauren, who are both also award-winning journalists from the ICMA, Iowa College Media Awards, you know, we are allowed to use that journalistic integrity and keep our public relations ethics, as Courtney mentioned, our journalistic ethics and our merits to kind of help us, you know, tell this story. And it's a really great balance of creativity and, you know, with the filming, but also telling a truthful and accurate story, which is what the journalist in us all really wants. But that creative side is still allowed to come out.
Do you plan at all to go into print journalism? Is that part of your focus as well? Or is it sort of not because of the situation in the newspaper industry?
Print has always held my heart. I love writing, and I love the physical newspaper. There's something about it that I don't think I'll ever not love. So I hope to eventually work in a print industry, but I know that the rest of my team has different ideas, and I love hearing them talk about themselves. So Nathan, you wanna start?
I can. I've also worked for the school paper for a couple of years, but I've always been more prevalent in video. So I've worked for our TV news station for a number of years, and then I work for our films organization now, and Dominic and I are both part of our video marketing team for the college. And that's kind of a little bit more of what I'm hoping to go into, is just kind of filmmaking and storytelling through that way, that I'm just a little more attracted to the visual medium. I'd rather be out in a field in the middle of nowhere with a camera, which there are shots like that in our documentaries. So I had a lot of fun getting those.
Yeah, I would say I'm definitely more on the visual storytelling side of things. You know, I love this project. I love things like this project in terms of documentaries and everything. But it's also, you know, being a digital cinema concentration along with PR, you know, video is so crucial in storytelling now, and especially because you have to be visually stimulated when you're on the internet and you're on social media. I think that side of things really appeals to me. And I think that my skills, like Nathan mentioned, you know, working with the college directly with the marketing and communication, as well as, you know, through our live broadcasting system here and all our work studies available on campus, I think I'm definitely leaning more towards the visual digital storytelling.
Okay, I'll go, Courtney. So I hope to pursue social media after I graduate, and I've also always had a love for writing, and I too am a writer for the Trumpet newspaper here on campus. So I'm also, with social media, I'm utilizing my writing talents as well as adding a little bit of creativity with the content I create for social media. So, I hope to do a little bit more with that after graduation.
Yeah, I would say I'm definitely pretty similar to Lauren in terms of social media and content strategy. but I love data analytics and content writing for like online platforms. And that's kind of been my connection to print journalism, is helping run our online news media aggregator that we kind of refreshed 2 years ago. So that was really exciting to be a part of that project. But I'm definitely looking to, you know, work in some sort of media or advertising agency and get involved there. And I've kind of found that I have a love for like food and agriculture advertising. I don't know why. Well, I mean, I grew up on a farm, but you know, here in Iowa. I think that there's something very easy to love about advocating for other people, like farmers or in journalism, through giving, like letting their voices be heard. And I think that's something all of us love about that.
Well, there, I noticed there's another member of your team. You referred to her, but she isn't here this morning. But does anyone want to tell us anything about Anshika Singh?
Yeah, so Anshika is our graphic designer, like we said, and she has such a pure, raw creativity for graphic design and like visual storytelling, kind of like Nathan and Dom, but definitely more in like static images, I think, is, you know, in photography and that sort of thing. And I'm really sad that she wasn't able to make it today. she is originally from Nepal, I believe. And so I'm pretty sure she, you know, went to like a high school with students from over like 90 different countries or nations or something like that. I think she can speak 3 different languages. She just has such a interesting and such a cool background. And I know next year she's looking to go to grad school on the East Coast. So she got into a few places out there. So I know she's really excited about that. And it's just been such a joy, I think, working with her this semester. So,
yeah, I would say Anshika is definitely one of the spitfires in our group who keeps us going. It's never a dull moment with her, and I mean that in the absolute best way. She came up with a really great concept for one of our infographics that we had to create. So Maria Pearson is from the Turtle Clan, and Anshika had this really great idea that what if we did a timeline of what it looks like in Native American activism, and we had all of these past events be a mother turtle, and the most recent ones or the most current ones are baby turtles that are pointing into the direction of the future. And the way in which that idea, we were all a little, I think, worried as to how it would turn out, because that's not a traditional way that a timeline looks. You know, when you think of a timeline, you think of a physical line, or at least, you know, a circle or something that will point in the right direction. And Anshika ran with her idea and it turned out incredible. I know we presented it to our advisor and our professor, and she absolutely loved it. The way that Anshika was able to tie in, you know, the story elements that we had all worked on together as a team. And then also, you know, found that one detail that was actually really important in Maria's life, and was able to tie that back in so our audience can recognize that, was incredible. And I love working with her. I love working with this whole team. We have all started together. It's hard to believe that 4 years ago, we were just first years in the department, not knowing what was going on, but it has truly been an honor to work with all of them. And I'm really excited to see what comes in April when we're allowed to premiere our documentary and all the hard work is finally on display for everyone to see in full, and we can stop talking it up. We can actually present it.
Yeah. I just adding one little thing. I definitely think our team just thrives on chaos, and we just have such a high energy, and like coming to class and to work meetings each day for this project is just, it's so exciting. There's never a dull moment, because you never know which one of us is gonna say something. And you know, even though this is like a very serious and meaningful topic to work on, like we are able to have that humor and silliness sometimes that kind of keeps us going. So it's definitely great, like Sylvia said.
And where will we and when will we be able to see this wonderful documentary?
It'll be premiering on our school's live streaming website on April 19th. That's, yeah, about 2.5 weeks from now, on Monday, April 19th at 2 p.m. on livestream.com/warpbirdnightvision.
And I think we're also, Courtney will be able to tell you more because she has built our website and made it look amazing. MyPeoplesBones.com has all the information and the process of our documentary. And we'll also have a link to that landing page on Night Vision, so that way you will be able to, whoever wants to see it will be able to and can have easy access. So I know that My People's Bones is a little bit easier to remember than the live stream link that Nathan mentioned. We have it memorized because we all worked there at one point in time, so that's nothing for us.
Have you guys thought about taking it and putting it in like maybe one of the small town theaters? Like I know a lot of around here, a lot of like Nevada, Story City have theaters that you can rent out and have a little premiere.
We're looking at the possibility of premiering it on PBS afterwards, but we're just going to take it one step at a time right now. Waverly's local theater has been closed, unfortunately, so we're a little limited in that respect, but I think we're going to explore that once we see how the premiere goes.
And our documentary will also be premiered with our other classmates. So it is Letters from a Young State, the story of Frederica Bremer is our one group, Vision Productions. And then there's Changing Hearts and Minds, the Ruby Sutton story by Ace Media. And so those are the other two groups. And so they will be premiering before us starting at 1 p.m. on that same link. And so what's really great about using that live stream link is alumni, parents, faculty, people like you guys at KHOI, you're able to watch that documentary kind of in a way like we would if we were to put it in a movie theater. Last year, when everyone was sent home a couple weeks ago, this time actually, we were able to all watch those documentaries and support our senior friends, from the comfort of our own home. And so that's what makes it really, really nice about having that live stream. If we were in a non-COVID year, as we like to call it here at Warburg, we would actually present these documentaries on what's called Rice Day. It's our research, internship, and creative endeavor day. And that would allow us to present these documentaries in front of our family, our friends, the whole Warburg and Waverly community, and anyone who was willing to come up to Waverly. And we would be able to speak a little bit about our documentary. And we are also given feedback and comments and sort of a live grade, if you will, from people within the department, but also we have a select group of people who grades our documentary from the outside, because this is still one of our final projects within the major. So I know that we're really excited to have it premiere. And I know Nathan and Dominic have been working hard on that editing, and Courtney's been working hard on the promotion, and Lauren has been keeping us in check every day, reminding us of what is due, because we have a lot of things due in a short amount of time. I mean, it's only been, what, 12 weeks, maybe less, that we've been working on this, because we started 10 probably, because we started off with 2 weeks of research. And after that, we began working on the script.
Well, this is fascinating, but our time is. And so we have to say thank you very much for coming.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. Remember that you can also hear it online at
khoifm.org.
That's my links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Local broadcast, Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m.
Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Other voices you heard were Mary Youngbear, Sylvia Oakland, Dominic Hansen, Courtney Stucker, Nathan Stephanie, and Lauren Wisdom. Our theme song is Backpacking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was from the video Last Tribe in Iowa.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website at khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you call to decide to become a member or renew your membership today. You can just get on the website and hit the yellow Donate Become a Member button. If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.